Disculpen. Vamos.
Let us continue our work. The ninth meeting of the ninth session of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is called to order. Distinguished members of the forum, this morning the Permanent Forum will take up item 7 of its agenda entitled Future Work of the Permanent Forum, including issues of the Economic and Social Council and emerging issues. We will hear presentations and discussion of the following reports: study on the impacts of global economic crisis on Indigenous peoples, report on Indigenous peoples and transnational corporations. In this ninth session, the forum will discuss a number of studies completed this year by the Permanent Forum. Aside from these reports, we shall take up studies on the rights of Mother Earth, and lastly, the report of the expert group on children and adolescents in situations of arrest or imprisonment. In our session today, we will study the impacts of the global economic crisis on Indigenous peoples. Mrs. Victoria Taulik-Bilkornik will present the results of the studies. Ms. Taulik-Korpus has the floor.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and good morning to everybody. This report is, I would like to first say that there is not a written submitted report on this yet because it's still a work in progress. But I will just present some of the initial results of the study that has been made with the hope that it will be completed before the session ends. During the eighth session of the Permanent Forum, a decision was made for the preparation of a report on the impacts of the global economic crisis on Indigenous peoples. And I was appointed to conduct a study on the impacts of the global economic crisis on Indigenous peoples, to identify measures and proposals for governments and the United Nations bodies, agencies, funds, and programs to address the impacts and to report thereon to the forum at its ninth session in 2010. This global financial and economic crisis and its social, economic, and environmental costs have been analyzed by numerous experts and by some UN bodies such as the General Assembly, DESA, and agencies like the ILO, WHO, UNESCO, among others, as well as commissions and conferences set up by the UN and other multilateral bodies. These studies and reports analyze the origins of the crisis, look into the situation of workers, the impacts on health and education, and the impacts on development, among others. However, not much has been written on the impacts of Indigenous peoples. So this report will try to consolidate the various scattered reports on how Indigenous peoples are affected and what their short and long-term challenges are in terms of addressing this impact. It will also link the special theme. I will also link this with the special theme of the forum, which is Indigenous peoples' development with culture and identity. The concluding section will discuss measures and proposals on how these impacts can be addressed. The financial crisis, which was triggered by widespread speculative lending and investment in major financial centers, has now led to the global economic crisis. When the subprime mortgage crisis struck the USA in 2007, which was characterized by bank runs and the collapse of major financial institutions like Lehman Brothers, it was inevitable that the real economy in both the U.S. and other countries who export to the U.S. will be adversely affected. We are now witnessing the most severe global recession since the 1930s. Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel laureate on economics, concluded that, and I quote, "This is not only the worst global economic downturn of the post-World War II era. It is the first serious global downturn of the modern era of globalization. America's financial markets failed to do what they should have done, manage risk and allocate capital well. And these failures have had major impacts all over the world. Globalization, too, did not work the way it was supposed to. It helped spread the consequences of the failures of U.S. financial markets around the world. September 11, 2001, taught us that with globalization, not only do good things travel more easily across borders, bad things do, too. September 15, 2008 has reinforced that lesson," unquote. In 2009, the Commission of Experts of the President of the General Assembly on Reforms of the International Monetary and Financial System, which is more popularly known as the Stiglitz Commission, was established. The Commission analyzed the origins and trajectories of this crisis. And they said, I quote, "The current financial crisis, which began in the United States, then spread to Europe, has now become global. The rapid spread of the financial crisis from a small number of developed countries to engulf the global economy provides tangible evidence that the international trade and financial system needs to be profoundly reformed to meet the needs and change conditions of the early 21st century. The crisis has exposed fundamental problems not only in national regulatory systems affecting finance, competition, and corporate governance, but also in international institutions and arrangements created to ensure financial and economic stability. These institutions have proven unable to prevent the crisis and have been slow to design and implement adequate responses. Indeed, some policies recommended by these institutions have facilitated the spread of the crisis around the world." Unquote. A common conclusion in these various reports is that the theory of self-correcting and efficient markets is debunked by this crisis. It is not just a result of a temporary malfunctioning or aberration of the economic growth model, but a clear failure on its own terms. Its promise of endless, stable growth and increasing volumes for most people has not come about. Instead, we have witnessed gross inequities, volatility, and ecological degradation. The New Economics Foundation, a respected think tank based in the United Kingdom, said that, and I quote, "These are not anomalies, but a natural and increasingly severe expression of the normal functioning of the system." Similar conclusions were contained in the Stiglitz Commission report, which says that the present crisis demonstrates failure at many levels of theory and philosophy, of institutions, policies and practices, and less overtly of ethics and accountability. According to Miguel Discoto, the General Assembly President, in his foreword to the report of the Commission, he said, "These crises are not the results of a failure or failures of the system. Rather, the system itself, its organization and principles, and its distorted and flawed institutional mechanisms is the cause of many of these failures." While there are claims that the world is overcoming this crisis, evidences show that most countries, both developed and developing, are still undergoing economic decline, and economic recovery is far from being reached. Yilmaz Akyüz, an economist who has looked deeply into this crisis, said that the combination of sharply declining commodity and manufacturing export earnings, collapse of remittances, reversal of private capital flows, rising risk spreads, an extreme degree of credit squeeze affecting even trade finance and losses of asset values is giving rise to a sharp economic downturn and even contraction in many parts of the developing world. Despite the massive bailout, operations through the infusion of capital into weakened financial institutions and industrial firms, there is not much to show in terms of economic recovery. For many indigenous peoples, they view this global economic and financial crisis as just one side of the coin. The other side is the global ecological crisis of biodiversity loss, resource depletion such as peak oil, and climate change. This situation the world faces now is clearly the direct result of the economic growth model, which promotes unfettered markets, export orientation, debt dependency, overconsumption, and overproduction. The Secretary General's report and the Division for Sustainable Development Trends report on sustainable consumption and production concludes that absolute consumption of resources has continued to increase with population, and gross development product in both developed and developing countries. Development has exceeded the carrying capacity of ecosystems in various geographic areas, whether measured by the footprint analysis or by the number of endangered species, degraded ecosystems and land, deforestation, or decrease in fish stocks. It is also clear that social inequalities are not being reduced with growth and globalization. In terms of social and economic, environmental, and cultural impacts, there are both adverse and positive impacts for indigenous peoples in both developed and developing countries. The extent of the impact depends on how the economies of the countries where indigenous peoples live are integrated with the global economy. Most countries are exporting primary commodities and semi-manufactured and manufactured goods to the USA and Europe and other OECD countries. As well, overseas contract workers go to the rich countries as well as countries in the Middle East and in Korea and other emerging economies. It was surmised earlier that the Asian countries will not be affected because they can decouple their economies from the USA. This was wishful thinking, however, because most economies of Asian countries were shaped to be export-oriented and debt-dependent, and liberalization policies were imposed and adopted by most countries. So we can see direct impacts on these countries as well as on indigenous peoples living in these countries. I would like to focus more on the USA because this is where the crisis has started, and I would like to look at some of the social and economic impacts on Native Americans, which are very direct. To begin with, the level of poverty amongst the Native Americans are already disproportionately high compared to the average American. The Harvard Project on the American Indian Development has documented that between 1990 and 2000, the poverty rate for Native Americans was more than two times the average for all Americans, and the unemployment rate twice as high. Cyclical and growing unemployment, rising energy bills and gas prices, and skyrocketing cost of food, housing, healthcare, and other necessities has plagued many Indians for generations. However, the current recession has worsened this situation many times over. This recession has diverse impacts on 360 historically impoverished American Indian tribes in the lower 48 states and has created an even larger gap between Native America's haves and have-nots. Several hearings were conducted in the Senate on the situation of Native Americans after the 2008 financial crisis, and this showed the diverse impacts. The gaming industry, for instance, has declined significantly as there are less people going to the casinos due to the crisis. It was reported that there is a drop of 9% and more in gaming revenues, which has affected 60 or 70 tribes with lucrative casinos, mainly with small populations and located in metropolitan areas. Massive layoffs of Indians has taken place in most of these casino gaming operations. The Mohegan Sun Casino in Connecticut, for example, had steady growth every year since it opened in 1996. In 2008, however, its slot machine revenues dropped, which led to a slowdown, and the casino cut the salaries of all 9,800 employees, of which some are Indians. There are almost 300 larger and more remote tribes in the Great Plains, Upper Midwest, and Southwest United States, some with marginal gaming operations and others with no casinos, whose poverty levels have significantly increased. It has to be noted in the first place that casinos do not meet all of the community needs in Indian country. Since the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act was passed in 1988, the gaming industry was established in various reservations, and this has provided employment to a significant population of Native Americans living on those reservations, and the revenue generated has supported many tribal government programs. However, out of the 561 federally recognized tribes, less than half of these are involved in gaming operations. Of the 367 tribal gaming facilities, the top 4% in terms of revenue generated more than 37% of all the revenues. Besides, data from the National Indian Gaming Association says that out of 670,000 Indian casino jobs, non-Indians hold 75% of these. One of the hardest hit sectors where Indians are employed is the timber industry. Because of the housing crisis, there is not much demand for timber. And based on the census three-year average from 2005 to 2007, natives are predominantly employed in the construction, extraction, maintenance, and repair sectors, with a full one-fourth of single-race male Indian workers working in these fields. These industries also comprise a substantial proportion of American Indian businesses. In 2002, nearly 3 in 10 American Indian-owned businesses were in these sectors, and 41%, which is amounting to $11 billion of Native American-owned business revenues, come from construction and retail trade. As with the timber industry, the construction industry has been hurt by the precipitous decline in housing markets that started with the recession we are currently facing. Ms. Jacqueline Pata, Executive Director of the National Congress of American Indians, revealed that unemployment rate soared between 50 to 90% during the recession. Unemployment in the Navajo Nation is reported to range from 50 to 55%. 8 of the 10 poorest countries in the United States are on reservations. The Wind River Reservation is located on 2.2 million hectares in central Wyoming, has an unemployment rate which exceeds 70%, and over 60% of the households live below the poverty line. With the 2008 recession, these statistics show even worse averages, not only for the national workforce, but for the Indian workforce. In the light of this data, I would like to just cite one more data. One of the data is the impact on health and the suicide rates. The rate of suicide among American Indian and Alaska Natives is 70% higher than the general U.S. population. Data shows that the 10 states with the highest percentage of Indians almost coincide with the 10 states with highest rates of youth suicide. Reports also show that indigenous women in Indian country are disproportionately affected by the crisis. The Indian Health Services unit at Rosebud Sioux Indian Reservation released an alarming statistic which shows that the suicide rate among the Sioux Indians is 200 per 100,000 for males ages between 15 to 24. This makes Rosebud the epicenter of suicide as it has the highest suicide rate in the world. In light of this data, the announcement of Ambassador Rice of the position of the U.S. government to review its position on the UN Declaration is very much welcome. This can be a major step towards the better resolution of the situation of Native Americans. It is my hope that this review will lead towards a change of position towards the endorsement by the U.S. of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Let me now briefly turn to the other regions of the world. I come from the Philippines, and I can speak of the situation of indigenous peoples in my country. In the region where I come from, the Cordillera region, the impact of the recession is very much felt. In the city where I live, there are several factories like the Texas Instrument, which has been there since the export processing zone was established in the 70s. Now it has retrenched almost 400 workers, many of whom are indigenous persons, and the exports of semi-processed conductors and microchips have decreased due to the crisis which has resulted in this. The situation in Southeast Asia has shown the rate of GDP growth has dropped from 6.5% in 2007 to 4.3% in 2008, but it is expected to plummet further to 1.5% in 2009. This has serious consequences for indigenous peoples because the levels of unemployment has likewise increased. Remittances of overseas workers contribute significantly to the gross domestic product of many developing countries. This is the case in my country as well as other Asian, Pacific, Latin American, and African countries. Among these, overseas workers or migrants are the ones who are suffering from the impact. The effect of the financial crisis was not only limited to economic and financial indicators, but especially to key social indicators. In the Philippines, company closures, bankruptcy, and constant layoffs were greatly affected. Has greatly affected the labor sector. The influx of overseas Filipino workers coming home was a result of companies that were badly affected by the crisis. The range of industries affected include electronic, metalwork, semiconductor, shipbuilding, telecommunication, advertising, information technology, hotel, extractive oil and gas, garments, and cruise vessel businesses. This is the same case with indigenous peoples from Latin America, such as Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, among others, and also in the Pacific. Tonga is an example where remittances contribute between 55% to 60% of gross domestic product, and the decrease in remittances has resulted to stresses, especially for women in their daily role as caregivers, protectors, and providers. Many indigenous territories are also earning from tourism, which has been seriously affected by the crisis. Fiji's response to the crisis, which is compounded by decrease on tourism, is bringing down the retirement age for public servants to 55. In Thailand, where tourism is the major source of income, the hill tribe people, who are also dependent on tourism-related livelihoods, are also affected. This declining commodity prices also as a result of this recession has negatively affected Indonesia, Thailand, Vietnam, and Malaysia, which stand to lose significantly. Exports have declined by 25% in Indonesia, 13% in Malaysia, and 32% in Vietnam. The downturn also hits farmers in food-exporting countries such as Thailand and Vietnam, and government revenues in oil-exporting ASEAN members such as Malaysia. The loss of income of indigenous farmers who are engaged in cash crop production and the increase of food commodity prices for food importing countries like the Philippines has led to food insecurity amongst indigenous peoples. I can go on and cite other cases in Africa and other regions, but I won't consume the time. So I would just like to mention also some of the positive impacts. Actually, in the Extractive Industries Conference that we held in the Philippines, one of the positive impacts which was cited by indigenous peoples is the decrease in mining exploitation in many of their territories because there are no investments coming into the countries to push for this exploitation. Therefore, there has been a break in some countries where the fight for indigenous peoples to have their rights to their lands be recognized and to fight against the entry of mining corporations without their consent has really been a welcome break for them. The other positive impact, of course, is in relation to also the issue of tourism. For many indigenous territories where tourism is a big industry, they have also mentioned that with the crisis, they are not now subjected to the influx of some of the unwanted tourists, especially those tourists who go to their communities for like pedophiles and other undesirable tourists who usually are seen in their own communities. So it's not as if the crisis has just a negative impact, it has also positive impacts. Of course, in the issue of environment, because there has been a decrease in industrial operations as well as extractive operations, even the Climate Change Convention has acknowledged that there is now a decrease in the increase of greenhouse gas emissions precisely because the production has really slowed down significantly. So maybe for the environment, there are some positive impacts. Now let me just end with some of the recommendations that are coming from many of the documents which I read. The first recommendation is in relation to the stimulus packages that are being given by the rich countries like here in the United States. When President Obama met with the American Indians and talked about the issues of Indians, he committed that economic stimulus will be provided to the Native Americans to address the issue of crisis. And I think many of the American Indians have presented their proposals in terms of how these stimulus packages be used. And what has come out in some of the documents I read is that they would like to use the stimulus packages to really redesign the kind of development that's happening in their communities so that they will not replicate the same kind of development which has led to this kind of crisis that we see now. They are wanting to recover their values and their tribal systems that are more friendly, not only among themselves, that are more in consonance with their cultures and identities, but are also more sustainable. So these are just some of the things that they are recommending, that in these stimulus packages, they should be involved in designing where these stimulus packages are going to be used, how they are going to be designed, and they should be the direct beneficiaries of such stimulus packages. The other recommendation is increasing the safety nets. Obviously, with all these impacts of the crisis, there is a need to increase the safety nets for indigenous peoples to be able to adapt to the crisis that has been caused by this economic and financial crisis. So they are suggesting that safety nets should likewise be designed and put in place so that they will be able to withstand, they will be able to last the impacts of this crisis. The third point is the issue of ensuring that rights and accountability mechanisms are also being put in place, and they have. This was mentioned because there has been some issues raised in relation to putting stimulus packages or the World Bank increasing its investment or its loans for infrastructures to stimulate the economies of the developing countries, and fear has been communicated in terms of how fast these infrastructure projects are going to be done and whether the free, prior, and informed consent of indigenous peoples are going to be obtained before these projects are coming to their communities. There's also a call to increase the accountability mechanisms, both of states as well as of international intergovernmental organizations. Finally, there also are proposals that the national institutions should be strengthened to enhance a more inclusive macroeconomic environment and to to change the macroeconomic policies of governments to be inclusive of indigenous peoples and indigenous peoples' economies as well as ecosystems. The last point I would like to say is that this crisis is both a risk, it's both a problem, but it's really an opportunity also for indigenous peoples, because many of the dominant economic theories of economic development are now strongly being challenged. It's an opportunity for indigenous peoples to bring into the fore their own economic thinking, the ways they think of their own self-determined economic development and social and political development, as well as their ecosystems approach to development. So I think indigenous peoples should be supported by the Permanent Forum as well as the UN agencies and by states to be able to realize their own self-determined development, because this is the kind of development that can really promote more sustainability and less possibilities of creating more crises in the future. Thank you very much.
Muchas gracias, señora.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Pauli, for that report. In fact, as you have just underscored, the economic crisis is an opportunity for indigenous peoples, and I think that we have used it very aptly, and we have advanced a proposal on the part of the indigenous peoples in for the sake of having a better quality of life and enhancing our relationship to Mother Earth. I think it is an excellent joint proposal. Now we will go on to examine the following part of item 7 on the agenda, the report on indigenous peoples and transnational corporations. The presenters will be the members of the Permanent Forum, Mrs. Elisa Kanki, Julian Silla, and then myself. Mrs. Kanki, you have the floor now. Let us wait a few seconds for our colleague to join us, and we will go on now to the report on the study on harmonization with Mother Earth. Bartolomé Clavero was to take the floor at this point. We've had a small difficulty. They aren't ready either to present. So we go on to the report on the expert group on indigenous young people and children in prison. Tonia Gonelia Frischner will be the first to speak. Madam Tonia, please. I was saying that we are going to read the report of the expert group on indigenous youths and children in prison. You will take the floor now, madam, and then and Andrea Carmen will read the following report. So you have the floor, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and warm greetings to you and to all the colleagues in the room this morning. I have the privilege of introducing the report of the International Expert Group meeting on Indigenous children and youth in detention, custody, foster care, and adoption. Mr. Chairman, in 2008, the son of one of our human rights experts, who we lost in 1999, Ingrid Washinawata, brought forward a recommendation to the Permanent Forum about his concern of children and youth in detention and custody throughout North America, and asked the Permanent Forum to look at this particular issue. And at that time, I had the privilege of sitting in the chairperson seat just temporarily at that moment while our chair, Vicky, had another assignment. And it was a momentous occasion to watch someone from a young man, a child turned into a young man making this incredible intervention. Members of the North American Caucus took this resolution very seriously and brought it forward in 2009. And with the support of the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, as well as the Permanent Forum, developed an expert group meeting with the leadership of Grand Chief Ed John, who unfortunately is not with us today, Andrea Carmen, Celeste McKay, and many other people from North America. And there was a meeting hosted by a wonderful community, the Tlaxcala Huatuth, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it, I apologize, Nation in British Columbia, Canada. They were just wonderful hosts. And what I would like to note before Ms. Carmen takes the floor, Mr. Chairman, is that the report last year of the permanent session included a strong recommendation to the Economic and Social Council to urge the governments ensure protection of children and youth while in detention and provide them with rehabilitation. This was something I brought forward at the meeting, and what I also stated at the expert group meeting was that the Permanent Forum encouraged governments, UN, and intergovernmental agencies and NGOs to collect and distribute disaggregated data on Indigenous children and youth in state detention. What the experts looked at at this meeting was they took a human rights framework for this meeting and they presented it based on key international norms and standards, including the preambular paragraph of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which states, if I may quote, recognizing in particular the right of Indigenous families and communities to retain shared responsibility for the upbringing, training, education, and well-being of their children, consistent with the being and rights of the child. Mr. Chairman, during our deliberation, I would like to note that we looked very carefully at the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978, that is a federal law of the United States. And we found that the United States was the only government in the world that had a federal law protecting its native children. And I just wanted to bring that forward to the chair. Mr. Chairman, it is my privilege to ask Andrea Carmen to bring forward the report of this excellent meeting. So I'll introduce Ms. Andrea Carmen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Gracias a usted, señora Carmen.
Thank you, Ms. Carmen.
For the presentation of this UN Expert Group Meeting, EGM, report on Indigenous children and youth in detention, custody, foster care, and adoption. The EGM was held March 4th to 5th, 2010, co-hosted by the UN Forum on Indigenous Issues and the Tsleil-Waututh Nation of British Columbia, Canada. EGM Chair Grand Chief Edward John is unable to join us today, so I am presenting this oral summary report as the EGM's rapporteur. The official EGM report is posted in its entirety on the Permanent Forum 9th Session website as e-c.19/2010/crp.8. I am very gratified to report to this session of the UN Permanent Forum on the very positive results of this EGM, which was attended by Indigenous experts from the Africa, Latin America, Eastern Europe, Russian Federation, Central Asia, and Transcaucasia, North America, and Pacific regions, as well as independent experts and representatives from the Permanent Forum, the UN Committee for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, CERD, the UN Expert Mechanism on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, the Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada, and the Organization of American States. Chiefs, elders, and community members of Indigenous nations from British Columbia and other regions of Canada, as well as representatives of the Canadian federal and British Columbia provincial governments, also attended as observers. Hereditary Frog Clan Grand Chief Edward John welcomed the experts and other participants. He also underscored that 50% of the children in government care in British Columbia, foster care and detention, are Aboriginal. And in the northern part of the province, it is close to 75% Indigenous children. United Nations Permanent Forum member Tanya Gonella Frischner noted that the report of the Permanent Forum's second session included a strong recommendation to ECOSOC to urge that governments ensure protection of children and youth while in detention and provide them with rehabilitation. She stated that the Permanent Forum can also encourage governments, UN and intergovernmental agencies and NGOs to collect and distribute disaggregated data on Indigenous children and youth in state detention. A human rights framework for the EGM was presented based on key international norms and standards, including the preambular paragraph of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, to which Ms. Gonella Frischner just referred. This framework also included a number of other provisions of the UN Declaration, the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and in particular its General Comment 11 from 2009, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, and ILO Convention 169. These affirm a range of relevant rights in the following areas. 1. The rights of Indigenous children and youth to be Indigenous and to continue to be part of their own nations, communities, families, and cultures. 2. The inherent and inalienable rights of Indigenous peoples to self-determination and autonomy, self-government, free, prior, informed consent, full participation in all levels and areas of decision-making. the right to maintain, preserve, use, and transmit their cultures to future generations, and the right to maintain the integrity and well-being of their families, communities, and nations. It also included the obligations of states to uphold and respect their international human rights commitments, including those rights affirmed in international human rights instruments, as well as those affirmed in nation-to-nation treaties concluded with indigenous nations. Indigenous experts spoke under the agenda items detention and custody, adoption, foster care, and causes, prevention, and healing the sacred hoop of our families and children. They addressed the continued legacy of removal policies in states such as the United States, Canada, and Australia, high rates of out-of-country adoptions from states such as Guatemala, and concerns regarding Indigenous children held in immigration detention facilities were also addressed. Several experts addressed the criminalization of activities which children and youth in extreme poverty use for survival, and ongoing impacts of economic marginalization and racial discrimination in many states. Experts consistently stressed the need to ensure direct involvement by Indigenous families and communities in decision-making about care and placement of their children, and the importance of culturally and spiritually based programs developed and implemented by and for Indigenous peoples, including support services for parents and extended families to enable children to remain in their care and custody. Summaries of all presentations by the experts are contained in the full report, which will be available in Spanish and French, in addition to English, in the coming months. The International Expert Group meeting adopted by consensus a number of conclusions and recommendations. These included: 1. Experts agreed that Indigenous children and youth are the basis for our survival as peoples. Their care, well-being, and integral development are our fundamental and sacred responsibilities in keeping with our traditional cultural principles and systems. 2. Experts recognized and welcomed the commitment of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in advancing the rights, survival, dignity, and well-being of Indigenous children as a priority focus of its work. 3. Experts agreed that existing human rights instruments form the international framework required addressing these issues using a rights-based approach. What is lacking is implementation. 4. Experts recognize the legacy and ongoing impacts of past removal policies and systems, such as the residential school system in Canada and the Stolen Generations in Australia, which were intended to produce assimilation and cultural destruction and resulted in all forms of abuse. These experiences continue to have serious and detrimental intergenerational impacts on the health and strength of Indigenous families and communities in the countries where they were practiced. 5. Experts agreed that discrimination, economic inequities, and racially discriminatory policies and practices continue to play a major role in the disproportionate placement of Indigenous children and youth in detention, foster care, custody, and adoption in many countries. 6. Experts noted the disproportionately high numbers of Indigenous youth in criminal system detention in many states compared to the rest of the population. 7. Indigenous young people are often criminalized by what are actually violations of states of their human rights obligations. These include racial discrimination, enforced poverty, economic marginalization, failure to protect children from all forms of abuse, including sexual abuse, treaty violations, and denial of access to traditional lands, resources, economic and subsistence activities. 8. Experts affirm the essential need to ensure full engagement and effective participation by Indigenous communities in designing preventative care, support services for at-risk families, children, and youth, as well as alternative placement options if required. Experts agreed that the lack of consistent disaggregated data on numbers of Indigenous children in various forms of state custody and detention presents ongoing challenges. Reliable data collection and assessment on such matters remains sporadic and selective, and in some cases, and in some states, it is non-existent. And 10, experts recognize good practices representing, in some cases, collaborative approaches undertaken by Indigenous peoples and states. These include the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada, the Saskatchewan Justice Commission, Treaty 6 Declaration on Child and Family Wellness, Erminskin Cree Nation Constitution, the work of the federal agency PANI in Costa Rica in collaboration with Indigenous communities, the Indian Child Welfare Act in the United States, although failures in its implementation were also noted, the draft charter of the rights of the Maori child in Aotearoa, New Zealand, among others, as well as various programs carried out by Indigenous peoples with or without state support to bring spiritual and cultural practices for rehabilitation of incarcerated Indigenous youth, as well as for family restoration and healing in the U.S., Aotearoa, and other regions. A number of specific recommendations to conclude were agreed to by consensus of the experts to present at this session of the UN Permanent Forum. Those specifically addressing the future work of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, which we hope will be taken into account by this session, include 1. Experts reiterate their call upon states to include the rights of Indigenous children and youth as a subject area in all their reports to UN human rights bodies. In particular, experts urge the UN Permanent Forum to monitor the implementation of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, General Comment 11, called Indigenous Children and Their Rights under the Convention of 2009 through state parties' reports to UN treaty monitoring bodies and the Universal Periodic Review process. 2. Experts strongly urge the UN Permanent Forum to call upon states to comply with CRC General Comment 11 in the interpretation of their obligations under the Convention on the Rights of the Child. 3. Experts request that the Permanent Forum present this EGM report to the Interagency Support Group and urge the group to pay close attention to the conclusions and recommendations which directly pertain to the work of their respective agencies. Further, the Interagency Support Group members be encouraged to implement the recommendations in CRC General Comment 11 within their respective mandates. 4. Experts recommend that the UN Permanent Forum develop an inventory of UN instruments in addition to the CRC to determine whether there is an opportunity to participate in the development of other general comments similar to and building upon CRC General Comment 11 that can have a positive impact on the rights of Indigenous youth and children and on the role of Indigenous peoples in protecting their rights. 5. Experts strongly encourage states to fully implement all human rights instruments that defend the rights of the child. Experts further call upon the UN Permanent Forum to encourage the United States to ratify the Convention on the Rights of the Child, as only one of two states which have not yet done so, and to encourage all states to address the rights of the child and Indigenous children in all forms of state custody when they are reviewed by the Human Rights Council's Universal Periodic Review process. 6. Experts urge the Permanent Forum to encourage all regional human rights systems to fully recognize the legal systems and traditional government structures of Indigenous peoples in these regions. 7. Experts urge the Permanent Forum to request a report to its 10th session in 2011 on the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal on First Nation Child Welfare, filed by First Nations Child and Family Caring Centre of Canada and the Assembly of First Nations. 8. Experts encourage Indigenous peoples to develop and restore their own healing and restoration models based on traditional concepts, practices, stories, songs, ceremonies, languages, worldviews, family and clan relationships, and to assess their effectiveness based on their own criteria and indicators for success. We call upon the Permanent Forum to compile and share these models with the agreement of the Indigenous peoples. While we also call upon states to recognize and support these traditional Indigenous models, we also strongly affirm that in no way does their validity and effectiveness depend on such recognition and support. 9. Experts call upon the Permanent Forum to urge states to promote special considerations for Indigenous children and youth in custody, in keeping with the recommendations presented in this report, and to submit reports on good practices, as well as measures taken to address bad or inadequate practices and situations. Further, experts request that states include updates on their implementation of existing international human rights standards in this regard to the Permanent Forum, including relevant provisions of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. 10. Experts request that the Permanent Forum call upon the Committee on the Rights of the Child, in keeping with Article 45C of the CRC, to request that the UN Secretary General conduct a study on the situation of the rights of Indigenous children, including the issues addressed in this EGM report, and addressing the need to collect and distribute relevant disaggregated data. And finally, 11, experts urge the Permanent Forum to conduct a follow-up seminar to monitor the implementation of the recommendations of the EGM and document additional good practices, solutions, and lessons learned in 2011 or 2012 prior to the 11th session of the UN Permanent Forum. In closing, we once again thank everyone involved in the implementation of this very important and productive expert group meeting, in particular the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, the host nation, and the participating Indigenous experts. We ask the UN Permanent Forum to give close consideration to these recommendations and to include them in its report for this session, as well as in the development of its plans for future work. For all our relations, Shioki Otesia.
Muchas gracias, señora Tonia Gonella.
Thank you very much, ma'am, both of you, for this excellent report on the studies done by the expert group on youths in situations of detention. Now we're going to give the floor Hassan Ibel Kassan and another colleague who will present the study to determine whether the measures dealing with climate change are in compliance with Indigenous guidelines. You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The study on the extent to which climate change policies and projects adhere to the standards set forth in the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. At its seventh session, the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues appointed Paimani Hasti and me as members of the Permanent Forums as a special rapporteurs to undertake a study to determine whether climate change policies and projects adhere to the standards in the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. At the eighth session of the Permanent Forum, Ms. Hasti and me presented a concept paper outlining of the framework for the study. We were of the view that the impact of climate change mitigation measures on Indigenous peoples on their land territories and resources highlights the extent to which climate change threatens indigenous peoples, particularly since the participation of indigenous peoples in climate change law and policies remains deficient. This study contains six parts on climate change, international climate change law and policy, climate change and indigenous peoples, climate change and human rights, the obligation to comply with the declaration, climate change and indigenous peoples' rights. The first part, climate change. The definition of climate change under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change is a change of climate which is attributed directly or indirectly to human activity that alters the composition of the global atmosphere and which is in addition to natural climate variability observed over comparable time periods. Climate change is mainly caused by greenhouse gases emissions, owing largely to the increase in the combustion of fossil fuels. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change posits that cause the temperature of temperature rise include human activity, including power generation, deforestation, transport, agriculture, and industry. Existence and project changes as a result of climate change include contraction of snow-covered areas and sea ice, sea level rise and higher water temperatures, increased frequency of hot extremes, heavy precipitation events and increase in area affected by drought, increased intensity of tropical cyclones. The second part, international climate change law and policy. The Framework Convention, agreed in 1992, provides the framework for the international response to climate change. It does not set out specific obligations and strategies which are to be addressed under subsequent agreement. It aims to stabilize greenhouse gas concentration in the atmosphere at a level that will prevent dangerous interference with the climate system. Article 2. The Framework Convention has been ratified by 192 states. International climate change law and policy revolves around the twin strategy of mitigation. A reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, and adaptation, an increase in the capacity to adapt to climate change. Under the Framework Convention Equity Principle, developed states as the principal producers of greenhouse gases historically and the most resource-rich are to carry a heavier burden in mitigation and adaptation strategies, including assisting to poorer countries and the development of technology. The Kyoto Protocol to the Framework Conventions detailed international climate change measures between 2008 and 2012, setting mandatory greenhouse gas emissions targets for developed states, establishing mechanisms to achieve this, including carbon trading and the clean development mechanism, permitting developed states to achieve their emissions targets through investment in emission reduction in developing states, and developing monitoring, reporting, and verification measures. It is ratified by 190 States. In 2007, the parties of the Framework Convention adopted the Bali Action Plan, under which they were to reach agreement on at the end of the 15th session of the Conference of the Parties in 2009. Long-term emission reduction, mitigation and adaptation strategies, technologies, transfer and development and appropriate financing and investment. The 15th session of the Conference of the Parties to the Framework Convention did not reach a final agreement on all issues, nor on proposals for the reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation rate. Deforestation and degradation has been estimated to contribute 18% of annual emissions of carbon dioxide. Although a reed agreement is close to being finalized. However, the majority of states agreed in the Copenhagen Accord, for example, that most developed states commit to implement emissions targets and provide resources. International climate change policy and law are highly politicized. The competing interest behind positions on climate change translate into numerous contentious issues such as contests over scientific assessment of severity and potentiality severity of climate change. Developed states are particularly concerned with the economic burden associated with responding to climate change. Developing states seek not to be hampered in their development by restriction on their use of energy when developed states were not so hampered, seeking discrimination, but simultaneously see their interests align with measures to mitigate and adapt to climate change. The lowest carbon emitters with the greatest vulnerability to climate change impacts, including small Iceland developing states, are some of the states calling for strong commitments. Oil-producing states are concerned about the economic impact of lower oil use resulting from climate change mitigation measures. Consequently, climate change policy may be determined as much by political compromise as by the need to reduce the impact of climate change. A number of climate change mitigation and adaptation measures have been implemented already from bodies as diverse as the Global Environment Facilities, the World Bank, to the United Nations, to state development funds. These include the establishment of funds to implement and manage mitigation and adaptation strategies, carbon markets, emissions offset regimes, caps on carbon emissions, pilot trade mechanism, and so on. There are also a number of voluntary carbon offset measures being developed and implemented at the states' level, domestic regulatory regimes to address climate change vary. Now I would like to give the floor to my dear colleague Paimani Hasti to finish the report.
Señora Paimani, tiene usted la palabra.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning to all. Since this is my first time taking the floor, I like, Mr. Chairman, to congratulate you for your election. If I continue on this study that I participated along with Hassan. This part that I'm going to mention is the climate change and indigenous people and their rights. Climate change mitigation and adaptation measures can potentially have impact on indigenous people's rights. For example, red policies can particularly affect indigenous peoples, given they oftentimes inhabit forested areas. Their close relationship to forest as the environment that sustains them, and their use and conservation of them. Numerous indigenous peoples participated in the COP15, and the reference to communities' engagement is included in the draft RED agreement. However, indigenous peoples continue to call for more comprehensive reference to dialogue that indigenous peoples' rights for all COP documents. The indigenous peoples' rights for participation, under that we did this study and assessment for climate change law and policy compliance with the declaration was suggested in the study. It must be borne in mind that some of the effects of climate change remain unknown, and climate change policy and law is evolving, making precise evaluation difficult for that. And indigenous people's right to participate in domestic and international climate change policy and law formation arises out of numerous declaration articles. If I can just mention the articles like 5, 3, 4, 5, 18, 19, 20, and I can continue to the 33 and 34. Indigenous people's rights to participate in decisions that affect them is set out in Article 18 in particular. Indigenous people's rights to participate is becoming stronger and stronger as climate change law and policy has more impact on indigenous people's lives in more localized contexts. And a UN Red Commission report states that, and I quote, consultation with indigenous peoples as well as other stakeholders is necessary to maintain the legitimacy and transparency of a proposed national or subnational Red scheme, end of quote. In practice, however, indigenous peoples were not adequately consulted in the creation of UNFCCC or in Kyoto Protocol negotiations and have had to resort to protest to facilitate their appropriate inclusion while requests for more participation have been rejected. For the area of the self-determination, we should say that the climate change law and policies can support an indigenous people's right to self-determination. For example, RED funding goes directly to indigenous peoples. It could be viewed as recognizing the authority of indigenous peoples over their own lands, territories, and resources, in the case of forests, of course, and their self-determination, Conversely, if RED funding is channeled through the state and the state does not recognize indigenous people's authority over their forests, indigenous people's self-determination may be perceived to be undermined. The right to self-determination includes the right of indigenous peoples to freely pursue their economic, social, and cultural development. It is supported by Article 20, under which indigenous peoples are entitled to engage freely in all their traditional and other economic activities. And Article 23, which articulates indigenous peoples' right to determine and develop priorities and strategies for exercising their rights to development, entitling indigenous peoples to also utilize their resources for development. Thus, climate change law and policy attempting to limit indigenous peoples' use of their resources could undermine their right to self-determination if it is devised without indigenous peoples' participation and, where necessary, consent. The right for land, territories, and resources in this study talks about the climate change context, which securing by securing indigenous peoples' ancestral lands, forests, waters, and resources, which provide the basis for sustainable local, social, economic, cultural, spiritual development. Diminishing indigenous peoples' land areas as a result of climate change, in the case of sinking islands and melting ice, highlight the need for international and domestic climate change and policy to aggressively mitigate the impact of climate change. In the interests of realizing the lands, territories, and resource rights in the Declaration. The loss of these territories has a significant consequence for other rights also, such as indigenous peoples' traditional activities related to resources, including hunting and fishing. Indigenous peoples' land, territories, and resources are particularly vulnerable to climate change policies and laws, especially where land title remains to be vested in them or in otherwise uncertain or challenged. Climate change policies to build dams and wind farms, to invest in trees, to plant for biofuel, for example, can all create incentives to deny recognition to indigenous people's lands and relocate them. And the right, under the right for to free prior and informed consent, FPIC, I should say the right to, the study says the right to FPIC is closely related to indigenous people's self-determination and other human rights obligations, especially the right to participation. It has been endorsed in numerous findings by, for example, the Human Rights Council, the Inter-American Human Rights Bodies, the Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, the Third Committee, the Human Rights Committee, and the Permanent Forum. Overall, initiatives to seek indigenous peoples' FPIC must always be undertaken in good faith. Free means that indigenous peoples are under no coercion, intimidation, or manipulation. Prior means that consent must be sought sufficiently in advance of any authorization or commencement of activities, and that respect be shown for time requirements of indigenous consultation processes. It should include accurate information about the nature, size, and reversibility of any project, as well as its duration and an assessment of its necessity, and be presented in a manner appropriate for the indigenous peoples in question. Opportunities need to be provided for indigenous peoples to debate and deliberate on any proposal that might affect them. In raising with indigenous peoples, states must be careful to engage with bodies that represent the indigenous peoples affected and respect indigenous peoples' institutional and decision-making structures as required by the Declaration. The Declaration also requires the states in international settings, such as under the UNFCCC, to comply with the Declaration's free, prior, and informed consent provisions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Muchas gracias, señora Paima.
Thank you very much, Madam, and Hassam. Now we will hear the study on indigenous peoples and corporations. I'm going to give the floor to our colleague, we've had a little difficulty, so now I'm going to open the floor for questions from our observers and delegates. Are there any questions from the observers? I'm referring to the studies that were presented. You have the floor.
Oui, Monsieur le Président. L'année dernière.
Mr. Chairman, last year, in the framework of this forum, and under the same topic, item 7, future work, your predecessor thanked FIDE for having set up a working group on the contribution of nomadic people to development. I would like to thank FIDE for that topic, and they indicated to me that, in fact, they were awaiting from the permanent forum to start up the work of this workshop or of experts. A whole year has gone by, and nothing has happened. In fact, this would be a workshop of experts on the people of Mongolia. Now, as the representative of the pastoral peoples of the world, especially the Tuareg, my question is, are we going to start the work of these experts on the nomadic people of Mongolia? And then how can we be sure that this working group of experts also be started up for the sub-Saharan African people? Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir, for reminding us of this recommendation. I am going to give the floor to the Secretariat representative to remark on this.
And indeed, this was one of the recommendations from last year's session of the Permanent Forum, not to have a workshop just on the pastoral and people of Mongolia, but on pastoral people more generally of the world. And as participants know, it takes a little time before we are able to gather funds and to put something like that together. But this is definitely a recommendation of the forum that is alive and well, and the Secretariat has been in contact with agencies and governments in order for us to be able to carry out this workshop, and hopefully before the next session this will happen and there will be a report to the next session of the Permanent Forum. Thank you.
Gracias a la Secretaría.
My thanks to the Secretariat. Once again, I open the floor for questions in connection with the studies that we've heard, specifically the report on young people and children in conditions of detention. The floor is open. I see no one asking for the floor, so let us move on then to our speakers list. I beg the people who have signed up to pay attention. The first speaker is Hilaria Supawaman of the Congressional Group of Peru and Vice President of the Indigenous Parliament of South America. You have the floor.
Así con la tapa señora Payune, chay furun indígena permanente en Escazutiuxta y Willarizarta presidente y mainas no canchispa causa ininchis ajay. Yachta Kunapi, Chaita, Presidente. Quiero decir, Presidente.
What I have said, Mr. Chairman, to all brothers and sisters of the Permanent Forum, and salute representatives of all countries. I am from Cusco, and my languages, Quechua, and in connection with climate change and the rights of indigenous peoples, as well as the rights of Mother Earth. But it's not only the Earth, it is our Mother Earth, Pachamama, and what climate change is doing to our most defenseless and vulnerable peoples. It is climate change that is affecting them most. Private capitalist companies have not taken into account the rights of the Mother Earth, because it is the Mother that nurtures us and provides us with food. It is the Mother Earth that provides us with water and air for humanity to exist. But what are the capitalists doing? They're polluting and killing Mother Earth. And in killing Mother Earth, they are also killing the indigenous peoples of Mother Earth. And it is they who have always defended Mother Earth over thousands and thousands of years. Chairman, this is my third year attending the forum, and the forum has issued declarations of the rights of indigenous peoples. But so far, until today, countries are not taking these declarations into account. And allow me to say that this year, in 2010, I would like to ask the forum, sir, to be more effective in calling on countries to implement these UN declarations. Furthermore, sir, in many of our countries, and for example, in Peru, in Colombia, and others, there is ongoing persecution of our leaders. When they begin to defend the earth, when they defend our earth against pollution of the air and the water and the soil, what happens? They are jailed, imprisoned, and killed. Because, as the world knows, last year our organizations also called for a visit from our brother from the Permanent Forum, Ama Anaya, and he, Dennis Amaya, recommended that these dialogue tables and the organizations from different countries send observers. But this recommendation was not accepted by the government. They did not take it into account, and there are no observers at these dialogue tables. That is why there are two reports, one by the state of the government and one from the indigenous organization. So what we are calling for, sir, is that we, the indigenous peoples, must get together to defend life, because the land is not exclusively for indigenous peoples. It is there for all human persons, and human persons must be aware that they must not pollute. They must take into account the lives of peoples and the life of the earth, because the earth exists and the rights of the earth must be respected. I believe that the forum should make the relevant suggestions and recommendations on the rights of the earth, because the rights of the earth are the rights of human beings, the rights of mothers, and the rights of mothers is the rights of women. The most vulnerable strata are women, because indigenous women are the ones called upon to provide food and find safe drinking water for their children. Mother Earth must be healthy to go on producing. And when the earth dies, there is no production. There will be no food. That is our great concern, Chairman. Therefore, I would like to call on this forum to take a vehement stand in the face of countries that are suffering great calamities because of climate change. There have been floods. There have been landslides. Homes have been wiped out. Many people have been left homeless. So it is all the fault of this climate change, sir. Therefore, we would also want the forum to focus on polluting countries such as the United States and other allegedly developed countries that are also polluting. They should provide remedies to these countries, as was agreed in Copenhagen. Let us call for compliance with Copenhagen, and I think the forum could forward this recommendation for compliance with the Copenhagen agreements and call upon the countries that have not done so to sign the agreements, because it is these countries that are doing the greatest pollution, sir. Now let us give the floor to the following speaker. Maria Sumire de Conde, who is a member of parliament in Peru. Is Ms. Sumire present? Could you raise your hand, ma'am, please? So then, let us continue with the presentation of the studies that have been done. I'm going to ask Pavel Zuliansiga to present the report on indigenous peoples and corporations. Mr. Zuliansiga, you have the floor, sir.
Si, please. Tiene la palabra, señor Zuliansiga.
You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Distinguished colleagues, dear friends, I would like to present my report, which was entrusted to myself and to my colleagues from Latin America, Carlos Mamani, and in making this report, I will do the following. In the documents, as well as on the site of the permanent forum, you will find my report, although it is in Russian. I will very briefly to tell you about this report. Indigenous peoples today are going through very difficult times in history. For some of them, this is a critical point in their history. Very broad industrial projects are going forward in practically all of these countries, linked firstly to the development of natural resources and economic development. At the same time, an enormous amount of the territory of these indigenous peoples is being reduced. Pastoral land is being reduced, and which is having a very negative impact on the indigenous peoples and the economic, cultural, and the spiritual lives of indigenous peoples. For some of these indigenous peoples, this is a real threat to their ethnic survival. The survival and prosperity of these people will depend a great deal on a well prepared and thought through economic planning of these governments, as well as work to ensure their ethnic and cultural development, as well as the protection of natural resources. This report could become the foundation for looking at these problems through the viewpoint of indigenous peoples. It will enable the countries to understand the aspirations and development needs of indigenous peoples. Now, this problem is not only acute, but is taking on increased importance since natural resource development is growing on the one side, and the fact that industrial production is having a major impact on indigenous peoples, as well as the economic relations between the indigenous peoples and their states. Industrial companies, corporations, natural resource industrial companies are also growing. Also, the role of international standards and practices is to be taken into account, as well as the technology used in the area of preserving natural resources, the issue of accountability, and providing for the rights of indigenous peoples. Countries of Scandinavia, North America, and other industrialized countries, in taking over indigenous peoples' lands and using their resources, has shown that at this point in time, this policy is becoming a policy of domination and paternalism with regard to indigenous peoples and their assimilation. This policy is accompanied by undermining the rights of using the resources by the indigenous peoples. The results have led to acute social problems amongst indigenous peoples, economic and social losses, the loss of price of appropriate pricing. It has led to grave social problems, alcoholism and suicide. Another factor is that the development projects with regard to indigenous peoples has undermined the processes of assimilation, since we need to find alternatives to these paternalistic policies. This is a vicious circle for the indigenous peoples, which is impossible to overcome because it is not based on prosperity. New models of relations with indigenous peoples have developed in the beginning of the 1970s of the 20th century. Over the past year and over the past period, indigenous peoples have provided for their own rights for self-determination and managing their own lands. This is an example from Greenland, for instance, in Denmark, in the northern territories in the USA and Canada, as well as Aboriginal management. At this time, it has become increasingly clear that the future of indigenous peoples will not only depend on maintaining the conditions for their traditional ways of life and in making sure that they are managing their own economies, as well as management of Aboriginal lands. As we have seen from the experience in Canada, better conditions for indigenous peoples will include networks of Aboriginal companies that use their own systems in their own industries and using partnerships or joint ventures. This is why Canada's policies with regard to indigenous people is based on the development of their human potential, of indigenous communities, and in establishing indigenous and Aboriginal corporations. In the north of the Russian Federation and their indigenous peoples, as well as using their own mineral resources, as well as undermining the rights of indigenous peoples in the north, in parts of the Russian Federation, have now been included in the policies of the past two decades. The economic policies of the Russian Federation using foreign investment, accounting for the social and ecological impacts of the petroleum producing industries in the north of Russia, also has been taken into account in providing for the rights of indigenous peoples. In the Hunter-Mansinian autonomous districts, radical changes have taken place in the traditional sectors of the economy. These regions now include representatives from the indigenous peoples in the legislative and executive branches of government. Experiences have been included working with local companies as well as relations between these indigenous peoples and natural resource companies. Indigenous organizations, two Russian companies, even Novotek, who is working in the area of gas production in the autonomous regions, as well as Ternes, who works in the area of in the forestry industry in the Primorsk region, has now made a contribution to working with indigenous peoples. The aim is to help indigenous peoples to realize their own potential, to develop their own relations with industrial companies, to work together with state as well as business representatives, and over to benefit from the industrial projects that are present in their regions. In order to reach these goals, as one of the authors of this report, have tried to do the following. I've tried to look at the international standards for the rights of indigenous peoples, the benchmarks that they use that we need to keep in mind in working with the natural resource industries, also in concluding contracts and agreements with industrial companies, and in taking into account other interests of indigenous peoples. Also to take up international experience of corporations and working with indigenous peoples to work on good practices. Also, to look at the role of the government as a guarantor of the rights of indigenous peoples in establishing relations with industry. Also, to take up models of partnership between indigenous peoples and corporations. One of the most important factors for indigenous peoples has become their right in the use of natural resources, industrial development of these resources as priority areas for development. Currently, in the agreements with indigenous peoples has become one of the mechanisms of ensuring that their rights are upheld. The legislative and international experience, as well as the experience in the Russian Federation in working with indigenous peoples, has led to the following results. First, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, the Convention of the ILO 169, as well as other international agreements and documents, guide states with regard to the rights of indigenous peoples to their lands and rights, and the resources. They oblige states working with indigenous peoples on conducting full-fledged consultations with indigenous peoples before these projects go through. Also, for the time being, we have not been able to fully take up the rights of indigenous peoples in line with international standards and legal instruments. At the same time, we have had successful projects in the use of mineral resources with regard to the indigenous communities and the successful projects that have existed. Thirdly, in many countries, the rights of indigenous peoples to their lands are a fact now, and this has become an integral part of the entire framework of the laws of using land and natural resources. The countries who have these laws realize that in looking at the potential of indigenous peoples, countries and states cannot merely go through without taking account of these rights. This is why projects go through only after the conclusion of contracts with indigenous peoples with regard to their land rights. This is conducted in many different sectors, fishing, forestry, using forestry resources in the area of investment services, transportation, building, telecommunications, as well as in specific mineral resource and projects. Contracts between industrial companies and indigenous peoples are also, contracts are also established in these specific cases. Also, there are agreements between states and indigenous peoples and industrial corporations. These contracts include specific and clear provisions, which include legislative obligations. And this is accompanied with the appropriate resources. Taking up the rights of indigenous peoples in industrial projects is important because it does pull up It does enhance the benefits of the natural resource used by indigenous peoples in their territories. Fifthly, in the Russian Federation, there is also a requirement to overcome the paternalistic approach vis-a-vis the northern indigenous peoples and taking up the interest of indigenous peoples in developing northern territories in line with global standards as well as international laws. As I have mentioned, there is already a certain body of practice that is available to the international community, including in the Russian Federation. One other main issue that has emerged with regard to the negotiations between indigenous peoples and industrial firms is how much do the interests of industrial corporations correspond to the interests of indigenous peoples? What we have seen in recent years is that negotiations and the agreements which have been concluded between industrial firms and indigenous peoples are playing an important role. Comparing the different experiences vis-a-vis these types of contracts has shown that in different countries, these types of contracts play different roles based on different rights and obligations in Canada. In the benefits to the local communities, companies are working in order to overcome the consequences of paternalistic policies. In the area of health, education, the prevention of violence in the families, as well as alcoholism. However, key measures which have actually changed the living conditions of people have become the integral rights of indigenous peoples to their land and self-determination rights to their territories. These have been good practices and have successfully impacted the well-being and the economic and social benefits available to indigenous peoples. Experience has also shown that the most important thing for indigenous peoples are not programs or creating structures to resolve isolated problems or only to provide for their governance or land rights. It is not the structures, but the people who make a difference, people who have now come to the conclusion these ideals are not empty words and that their future is held in their own hands. This is a faith as not just a hope for the future, but a true outlook for the future is not based on paternalism, but based on the state's recognition that the past has been unfair and that fair and just relations must be put in place for indigenous peoples and overall state. These are mutually supporting arrangements. This is why key measures are the measures that look at indigenous peoples as a nation, people who share their own self-awareness and who live in specific areas or neighboring areas who have their own territorial and resources for economic development and their own government structures, which are on an equal footing with the national, regional, and central government structures. I have provided you a very brief report with regard to the research and results that I have included in my report. As I've said, that you can have a more detailed look at this report, which is a very thick document. And in my opinion, as you have already ascertained, in previous sessions, we took decisions with regard to having three special reporters on this topic, because this is a very important and very acute topic for us today. So I believe that it is very important for the Permanent Forum to continue to working along these lines, because based on the reports that we present today and that I have presented, show very clearly that very major areas of our planet that are inhabited by indigenous peoples are still not covered by these reports. And it is important for these reports and these studies to be conducted in many of the regions where indigenous people live. As I said at the beginning, this is a very key topic, and the future of the indigenous peoples will depend on it. Thank you.
Muchas gracias, señor Pavel Zulian.
Thank you very much, Pavel Zulianziga. We had an opportunity to see a film, and the film, as was said, begins with scenes in a mine where huge machinery dig into the earth of indigenous lands. And this is the reality of many indigenous people. So the announcement made by our colleague Pavel on the existence of at least two companies in Russia that do respect indigenous people's rights and can be taken as examples of best practices in connection with how corporations and indigenous peoples, in coordination and with respect to free determination, can find alternative routes to development that will not exploit the territories of indigenous peoples. Going back to the film, it is important to recall the colonialist view that most transnational corporations have in their dealing with indigenous peoples. I think we cannot find in the South a single case, in South America, I mean, a single case of a company that is responsible in their dealings with indigenous peoples, or that has respected indigenous peoples' rights, or that has even taken the minimum safeguards to avoid polluting the water and the resources that are vital for the existence of the indigenous peoples. I believe, as Pavel said, this is an effort that we must all make together to cover the entire earth, wherever indigenous peoples live, to ensure that the face-off between indigenous peoples and the corporations will not be one-sided, especially where mining is concerned. So I want to thank Pavel for this study, and we are going to try to present it as part of a single report. Now we will go on to our speakers list. Let me ask once again, Maria Sumide de Conde, Member of Parliament of Peru, are you here? You have the floor, madam. As I said previously, let us be fair with the use of time, because we have a great many delegates who have not an opportunity to speak. So we're going to work with our little time control machine. And please be understanding in observing the light when it goes on. Your time has run out. Madam Conde, you have the floor. Dear brothers and sisters, I bring to you the special greetings of the Quechua peoples living in the high Andean mountains of Peru. Our Pachamama, in this part of the world called Peru, has 117 zones, and 28 of the total number of climates in the world, 28,000 species of flora, 75,000 endemic plants, 4,200 native plants used by the population, 128 domesticated native plants, 2,000 ocean species and 3,000 orchids in access to four macro basins. And it is a country rich in biodiversity, but we also have a cultural wealth of which we are very proud. We are 72 indigenous peoples, of which 65 are Amazon nations and 7 are Andean nations, living in 17,000 communities throughout the ridge. As original peoples, we are currently having to suffer the mining boom. More than 17 million hectares were given in concessions to mining companies, and 55% of the Andes communities have been ceded to the mining companies that are working with no respect for Mother Earth, destroying Pachamama and polluting our rivers just to ensure that these concessions are given to them. A legal framework has been structured that violates the rights of the indigenous peoples and respect for Mother Earth, and also brings Peruvian law in contradiction with international laws defending these rights. The citizens' protest is criminalized, and fierce prosecution is unleashed against the leaders of the affected communities. In sum, there is a violation of the rights of the indigenous peoples. Migration of the Amazon and indigenous peoples are forced to emigrate because of the violations of their rights. And lastly, there is an aggression against our rivers, our earth, our health of the indigenous peoples, who are the main guardians of our indigenous wealth. 11.8% of mining activities are in extremely poor communities, and a higher percentage in generally poor areas. The indigenous peoples are now 45 million peoples. That is why we must strengthen our actions in defense of those sectors of society that are fighting against the effects of climate change. We must monitor the countries with the greatest pollution, and there where there is biodiversity, the existing regulations must be defended, and we must enter into new agreements to implement these laws that respond to the world view of the indigenous peoples. Thank you.
A usted, señora congresista.
To you, Madam Parliamentarian, thank you. Now we're going to open the floor to the caucus representative, Mr. P.E. Tsu of the World Youth Caucus. Mr. Tsu, or Ms. Tsu, forgive me.
As part of the planning for future work of the permanent forum, we would like to hereby address a couple emerging issues pertinent to indigenous youth. Economic sovereignty is the key to the overall sovereignty of our people. The recent global economic crisis has worsened the poverty condition and livelihood of our family. Indigenous youth workers are forced to work longer hours and to sustain income. This has threatened our right to education and equal opportunities. By educating the youth, we can grow stronger as an indigenous community. Education is the fundamental right for indigenous youth. However, not all indigenous youth have equal access to education designed for our need in our language and reflects our worldview. We should put priority on revitalizing our language and our culture. Mr. Chairman, climate change is another pressing issue which endanger the livelihood of our family. With increased exposure to natural disasters, our people are becoming climate victims. We are forced to relocation and dispossession of our lands. Our culture is uprooted from our traditional territories. Mr. Chairman, it has also come to our attention that some of our indigenous brothers and sisters do not have equal access to the permanent form. The UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People reaffirms that we, the indigenous people, should be free from discrimination of any kind when we are exercising our rights. Indigenous youth especially should have equal rights to attend the permanent forum and learn from the forefront of indigenous works. Recommendations. First, we urge the permanent forum to review problems of property and land rights, and to reassure that developments are not at the cost of indigenous peoples. We urge governments to stop forced relocation and grant legal recognition to the ownership and control over our customary lands and resources. Second, we highly recommend that the permanent forum work closely with UNICEF and other UN agencies to empower future indigenous leaders. Third, we request action plans and strategies to be discussed in the permanent forum for the reduction of education gap between indigenous and non-indigenous. We want an education that will end discrimination against the indigenous people and promote respect of our culture. Fourth, grant access to the permanent forum based on our indigenous nation, rather on states, and restore the mislabeled indigenous youth whose bloodline is mixed due to colonization. And last but not least, that all governments should have legal system to protect and represent indigenous people. In 2007, the Vietnamese government arrested, defrocked, and imprisoned these three former Khmer Krom monks who are standing behind us today. We recommend that governments, especially the Vietnamese government, respect the freedom of religion and have legal system to protect victimized people. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I would like to warmly thank the representative of the Youth Caucus for their excellent statement, and to remind you that the youth voice here at the Permanent Forum is a critical voice, and that we take your voice very, very seriously and look forward to reviewing your recommendations very closely. Thank you very much. I would like to call the next speaker on our list, Jethro Tullian from the Pacific Caucus. Sir, you're in the room. Mr. Tullian, you have the floor.
Okay. Intervention of the Pacific Caucus, item number 7. Madam Chair President, this intervention is presented on behalf of the Pacific Caucus regarding the future work of the Permanent Forum. Indigenous peoples and corporations. Indigenous communities in Australia, Papua New Guinea, New Zealand, Vanuatu and Kanaki, New Caledonia, under increasing pressure from states and the extractivists to gain access to traditional lands, particularly in resource regions. Traditional owners must be engaged in all decisions which are based on free, prior and informed consent. We call on the Permanent Forum to argue all states to appoint a commission for social responsibility to develop standards in relation to the extractive industry, including standards that mitigate as well as possibly the negative impacts of resource projects on local communities. Indigenous communities have spiritual and customary association with fisheries resources. However, there is no comprehensive recognition of fishing rights in many parts of the Pacific. National recognition is a priority, and concessions must be made to address unreasonable and restrictive licensing regimes imposed by many states. States such as Australia, France, Chile, and the U.S. must formally implement and give prior meaning to the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples as it applies to Pacific nations. Report on Indigenous Peoples and Boarding Schools. As human rights are universal and indivisible, Indigenous young people should not forgo their rights to self-determination and cultural integrity to realize their right to education. Indigenous peoples must always, as a first option, be able to assess the highest standard of education in their homelands. The impact of policies assimilation on Indigenous youths must be recognized, and all education policies must be consistent with Article 14 of the Declaration, which emphasizes the importance of education and culture to Indigenous peoples. States in the Pacific must distribute educational resources equitably and provide adequate financial support for education of Indigenous peoples of culture, tradition, and education in their languages, including higher education. We recommend that states develop national benchmarks on educational standards to monitor effectiveness, taking into account the importance and diversity of Indigenous peoples' culture and generally in educational experience. We further recommend that state use and develop technology and distance education to enable Indigenous peoples in remote areas to receive excellent education in their homeland. Rising sea levels associated with climate change threatens many islands in the Pacific region and threatening supplies of fresh drinking water. In repatriation of traditional country due to submission of Inuit Nation will have a detrimental effect on the health and well-being of Indigenous peoples. The Anchorage Declaration represents the position of the world's Indigenous people and should be acknowledged and supported by all states. Any climate change schemes must recognize the rights of Indigenous peoples and must uphold right to full and effective participation in its development and implementation. Decisions should be based on free, prior, and informed consensus and the potential contribution of Indigenous people towards resolving the climate change crisis must be acknowledged. Preliminary study on the impact of Indigenous peoples of the Indigenous International Constructive known as the Doctrine of Discovery, which has served as the foundation of the violation of their human rights. The Doctrine of Discovery is akin to the Doctrine of Terra Nullius applied in Australia. Both have a history of entrenched racism and genocide and have been used to rationalize the deportation of Indigenous peoples from their lands and water and to justify non-recognition of their political sovereignty. We recommend that the Permanent Forum undertake a comprehensive review of the Doctrine of Discovery and the Terra Nullius with regard to Indigenous peoples' inherent right as recognized in the Declaration on the Right of Indigenous Peoples. Key findings and recommendations should be submitted to the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues in 2012. Support of the expert group meeting on Indigenous youth and children in detention. The human rights and fundamental freedom of children and youth in the Pacific are severely threatened by alarming high rate of incarceration and continued rise. Incarceration removes our children from their land and culture and impacts their health, well-being, and growth. We argue the Permanent Forum to require all states to divert Indigenous children and youth away from detention and custody as a matter of priority, using detention as a matter of last resort. Divisionary programs should be developed and facilitated in partnership with Indigenous peoples and organizations. We further argue the Permanent Forum identify mechanisms to increase accessibility and participation of Indigenous children and youth in the UN system. Discussion on Indigenous people and forests. In the Pacific, on islands, forests are an integral part of Indigenous life. For these in lower-lying regions and atolls, the coral in the waters are our forests and eagerly need protection. The forests are rich source of our culture, economy, and are occupied and used for food, medical, spiritual, cultural, social, and economic purposes. Unsustainable logging, poor water management, urban spirals, mining, and other development endanger our forests. We ask the Permanent Forum to argue states to fully protect Indigenous knowledge and culture heritage within forests by fully adopting the AquaCon guidelines and encourage the participation of Indigenous peoples in monitoring and reporting, including Ramsar sites and other sites of international significance. We further recommend that the state use and develop technology and distance. Further, all states should review sustainable logging and extraction activities as well as water management and right to free, fair, and informed consensus must be available. Relocation of the Permanent Forum, Madam said last one. Finally, we recommend the Permanent Forum move between the regions annually to allow fair and equitable access to mechanisms. While the renovation continue at the UN building in New York, with success, the Permanent Forum consider relocating to Bangkok to increase the potential for participation by Pacific delegates who should otherwise be unable to offer to attend the forum. To facilitate the relocation, we recommend the forum train interpreters based on all regions to standard required by the United Nations. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Talian, for your excellent report. And I'd like to also thank you for your close scrutiny of all of the different reports that have come out of this meeting. Certainly, you look very closely at the expert group meeting on Indigenous children in custody, the preliminary study on the doctrine of discovery, and all of the other reports. It's a lot of work, and on behalf of myself and the other members of the Permanent Forum, we thank you for your good work. The next person on my list is the representative of the Australian Caucus, and I'd like to recognize Ms. Sandra Creamer. Ms. Creamer, are you in the room, please?
Please raise
your hand. Oh, Mr. Creamer, a gentleman is going to be speaking on behalf of the Australian Caucus. Sir, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm deputising for Ms. Creamer, who is taken ill. My name is Neil Gillespie, and this intervention is presented on behalf of the Indigenous Peoples Organisations of Australia present at this forum. The human rights and fundamental freedoms of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and youth in Australia and Indigenous children and youth around the world are severely threatened by alarmingly high rates of incarceration that are continuing to rise. Indigenous children and youth often face disadvantage and marginalisation from birth until adulthood and is characterised by intergenerational poverty, overcrowding in poor housing conditions, low levels of literacy and numeracy, low quality of health and well-being and life expectancy, welfare dependency, social marginalisation, poor and unsuitable service delivery by governments, inadequate resources, funding and support for culturally appropriate Indigenous-owned and controlled services, and finally, over-policing, targeting and discrimination by police and law enforcement agencies. Programs need to address these multifaceted and interrelated considerations to overcome disadvantage, marginalisation and the structural impediments and barriers to justice systems that all impact on the high involvement of Indigenous children and youth in detention and custody. A particular framework providing successful proving successful in mainstream communities in the United States of America and the United Kingdom is justice reinvestment, which is a localised criminal justice policy approach diverting a portion of funds for imprisonment to local communities where there is a high concentration of offenders. Justice reinvestment was recently recommended by the departing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner of Australia and is supported by the Indigenous Peoples Organisations of Australia present at this forum. Our recommendations are, Madam Chair, that the Permanent Forum urge states to divert Indigenous children and youth away from detention and custody as a matter of priority, using detention only as a matter of last resort. That the Permanent Forum urge states to engage and consult with Indigenous peoples and organisations to identify causal factors and strategies to overcome the disproportionately high level of involvement and over-representation by Indigenous children and youth in the justice system. Thirdly, that the Permanent Forum urge states to provide resources to empower Indigenous organisations where possible to implement culturally appropriate programs that prevent, intervene, divert and rehabilitate Indigenous youth in the justice system through counselling, mediation, employment, education and cultural and family reconnections. The Permanent Forum should encourage discussion and input from states and Indigenous peoples and organisations about best practice models such as justice reinvestment and consider how to encourage a framework for broader application beyond local settings. And finally, Madam Chair, We urge that the Permanent Forum work to identify mechanisms for increasing accessibility and participation for Indigenous children and youth in the UN system, to highlight their issues and concerns directly with the international community, including consideration of an international complaints mechanism. Finally, Madam Chair, please note that a more comprehensive report on these issues has been provided to the Permanent Forum for its consideration. I thank you.
I'd like to thank Mr. Neil Gillespie for your very good presentation and your excellent recommendations on Indigenous children. We look forward to giving a close scrutiny to many of your recommendations. So thank you, sir. The next speaker on the list from the region of Russia and representing the Youth Association of Finno-Ugric Peoples is Mr. Alexei Zikrev. Mr. Alexei Zikrev?
Yeah.
Are you in the room,
yeah,
sir?
Yeah, he is. He's over there.
Great. You have the floor, sir.
Madam Chair, distinguished experts, forum participants, the International Movement of Finno-Ugric People would like to thank the forum for the successes noted in the safeguarding of the rights of Indigenous peoples and the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. For 20 years, this movement has been in favor for this declaration to play a decisive role in the national and regional policies of government. We have, however, seen with concern that the fact that Russia does focus on Indigenous peoples. However, that notion of Indigenous peoples is not included in the Russian text. However, the notion is the groups of people who are fewer in number, who are 50,000 people or less. The notion of Indigenous peoples, which is used at the international level and in documents on the rights of Indigenous peoples, would correspond better to our interests. In spite of the lack of formal bans on the gatherings or congresses of Indigenous peoples, the notion of a People's Congress of Indigenous Peoples does not exist in the Russian Federation, especially where they are living in high-density areas. This does not correspond to the social and economic priorities for Indigenous peoples. Of course, for the Finno-Ugric people in the Russian Federation, high on the agenda is the safeguarding and development of the language and cultures of the Indigenous peoples. Less than half of Indigenous peoples speak their mother tongue, and the natural transmission of the mother tongue from generation to generation has almost completely been eliminated. We believe that this is a very problematic situation, as has been classified by UNESCO documents for the classification of Indigenous languages. We believe that immersion programs need to be in place for mother tongue Indigenous populations. We believe that the economic crisis has forced governments at the local level to start looking at professional arts and to apply a mathematical approach to assessing culture. And so, for example, you can not look at the quality of a theatrical production in an Indigenous language, but to look at the hard numbers and the profit made from these activities. The Finno-Ugric people believe that a promising outlook is to be had in safeguarding regarding the objects of intangible heritage. Now, countries which have ratified the UNESCO Convention on Safeguarding of Intangible Heritage can develop their own list of cultural heritage sites, even if they have not joined the UNESCO Convention. And we believe that countries need to do those. This convention will safeguard indigenous peoples from the negative impact of business, for example. For example, we are also looking at areas of use of natural resources. For example, in some of the regions of Russian Federation, it has meant that indigenous peoples have almost had to buy quotas for their fishing catches. And in managing their fishing management, we believe that countries who have not joined the appropriate conventions need to safeguard the rights of indigenous peoples, no matter what percent of the population they make up. We believe that also in the forestry resource area, standards need to be used. There is a certification program, for example. There is the FSC, the Forest Support Committee, which has enabled indigenous populations to use these certificates in using, for example, forest lands or forest clearance. We call upon the forum to help the greater use of this type of forest certification. At the last 5th World Congress of the Finno-Ugric people in the Hantamaninsk region, the presidents of Russia, Hungary, Finland, and Estonia were present. This bears witness to the importance of states, NGOs, and business to the importance of indigenous peoples, as well as the role of youth. Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank you for your contribution to this discussion. Thank you very much, sir. And I'd like to call on Mr. Jean-Georges Bidard from the Trade Union Gerebid Ekatria from the Europe region of France.
You have the floor, sir.
I see you, and you have the floor, sir.
Yes. Egunon bertatutako guziei. Salutations à tous les représentants de l'instance permanente et au peuple.
Our salutations to all members of the permanent forum and the peoples represented here. We speak on behalf of Garabit, the Trade Union of the Basque people. We speak within the context of original peoples to underscore an essential issue, which is the comprehensive development of the peoples, and it begins where there is a collective experience, social capital, and an identity. The languages and original cultures are one of the fundamental parts of an identity and one of the most important acts of a community. When the language disappears, the people disappear with it. The Basque people are considered one of the oldest original peoples of Western Europe, and they preserve one of the most ancient languages of the world, Euskada, which is thousands of years old and has survived despite the invasions and conquests. Although we enjoy economic development, we believe that our full development as a nation can only be possible if we are capable of maintaining our identity and our language and our way of being. What is the use of having economic development if we do not help people survive? Euskada, this language is so ancient, and it is part of the heritage of humanity and is part of the heart of our people and our culture. Although we still suffer discrimination and lack of official status in certain territories, specifically in the French territories, in the regions in the south of the Basque Country, there has been a renaissance, a struggle based on the drive for identity recognition. And we are having teaching in our original languages, as well as entertainment and television networks to have, and we also have our internet personality. Our culture is flourishing as a modern and ancient culture, where the post-modern and the prehistoric come together for the future. We are working to keep our language, which is in danger. But aside from speaking from our people, we want to mention the following points. First, a message of alarm. Most of the languages spoken by people's representative in this room are in danger of disappearing. When they disappear, it is a nation that disappears. We need to have adequate diagnostics. The indigenous languages are severely ill, and they will certainly die without care. The second message is one of hope. It is possible to have a culture flourish, and its languages must be protected in the future. Thirdly, we want to convey a message of responsibilities. Rights are important, but they are not enough to have rights before international organizations and governments. It is the responsibility of peoples to create their strategies. This is the only way to survive and develop comprehensively. We want to share what we have learned in the experience of our own language with other languages. We have created our Garabide organization to share this experience so that together these peoples can work together to recover their languages and cultures. We will conclude with a recommendation to the Permanent Forum. That is to reflect. Thank you very much.
Who's the next speaker?
Oui. Oui, on va la photocopier.
Ethiopia.
Ethiopia, okay. Thank you very much, sir. The next speaker on our list is Sandra Nelson Zongo. She represents the Ethiopian World Federation of Ethiopia. Ms. Zongo, are you in the room? Please raise your hand if you're in the room. Sandra Nelson Zongo? No, let me move to the next speaker on the list, please. Ivan Toring of the Asia Pacific Youth Network. Over on the side. Ivan, you have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Ay kanan kano di ulalim we enta kuman kabla awan nanada ay amam ayat inin a isna ay pagilian. To all the members of the United Nations, all state representatives, distinguished guests, indigenous organizations, and participants, good day to all of you. I am Ivan Torafing, an Igorot from Cordillera, Philippines. This is a statement of the Asia-Pacific Indigenous Youth Network. Once again, thank you, Madam Chairperson, for giving me the chance to present this statement in connection to the expert group meeting on indigenous youth and children in detention. This opportunity is highly significant to voice out the situations and problems confronting youth and children in indigenous communities. Furthermore, to challenge each and every one of us, especially the Permanent Forum and the concerned agencies and indigenous organizations, to take action on these problems. Madam Chair, let me draw your attention to the increasing number of indigenous youth in detention centers and in prison. In many conflict-prone situations in Asia, indigenous youth continues to be subjected to emergency legislations and national security laws, where their fundamental rights continues to be violated with impunity. International policy advancements on children and youth continue to be inapplicable and unimplemented in many of the conflict-afflicted indigenous peoples' territories in Asia. Madam Chair, all of us become a child and youth once in our lives, and I believe that everybody do not want any youth and children suffer violence. for the interest of all indigenous youth and children and their communities, these are our recommendations. We call on this permanent forum to urge all states and governments to ratify and implement all human rights treaties, particularly the Convention on the Rights of the Child, Convention Against Torture, and International Convention on Civil and Political Rights for full protection of human rights of indigenous youth and children. We call upon all member states of United Nations to ensure full implementation of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, particularly the right to self-determination. By doing so, we hope for the full protection of our land and resources, which defines indigenous peoples' culture and identity. Without it, the children and youth of any indigenous group were not able to live with their culture and tradition. We call on the UNPFII, Special Rapporteur, all states and other human rights bodies to take initiative to end the violence against youth and children. Also to secure the rights of indigenous peoples to fight for their rights, especially the youth that are arrested, accused of collaborating with secessionist groups in the struggle to defend land and resources. We would like to call on states for recognition of full participation and proper presentation of indigenous peoples in decision-making processes regarding policies for rehabilitation of indigenous youth in prisons and juvenile justice protection. In particular, the youth and children should be given the chance to participate in defining the programs that would address their needs. We call on the UNICEF to conduct independent studies and analysis of the situations of indigenous youth imprisoned in different indigenous countries and the continuing human rights violations. We call on all UN agencies to support the indigenous people's organizations and human rights organizations to conduct studies and researches on indigenous communities regarding imprisoned indigenous youth and children. We urge all states and governments to implement child-friendly legislations with due participation of indigenous peoples. Furthermore, to ensure greater protection and proper treatment to indigenous children and youth while in prison and in detention centers, and to provide them with socio-educational measures for their rehabilitation. We call on the international funding agencies and governments to provide support on indigenous communities to avoid children and youth engaging in petty crimes because of extreme poverty. Moreover, to provide funding for the youth-initiated activities and projects, and also to support indigenous youth participation and involvement in the future sessions of United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues and other related events concerning indigenous populations. It is an honor to participate in this gathering to convey the voices of children and youth in detention. We hope that the voice of children and youth in this permanent forum will be heard and addressed. Agbyag dagiti na insigudan nga umili, long live the indigenous peoples of the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Torfing, for your well-presented intervention today. We do appreciate it. I would like to ask the Kauani Foundation from the Pacific region if they are ready to present their intervention.
Madam Chair, there's been a mix-up and a change, a correction. Actually, the presentation will be by Kenneth Deer on behalf of the Indigenous World Association.
That's fine. Just one moment, please. And that does include your foundation, so it's a joint statement. Is that correct?
Actually, it's a collective statement.
Yeah. Huh?
Pardon me?
On behalf of which organizations?
Yeah.
Okay.
On behalf of which
organizations?
I don't know.
Okay. So for our records, we need to know if this is a joint statement, number one, and who are the organizations that are part of the joint statement, number two. So before I give the floor to Kenneth Deer. So if you could do that, please.
Okay, this is a collective intervention, and it's given by Indigenous World Association, which is ECOSOC, on behalf of Nakoi Kaika o Kalahui, Hawaii, the Kauani Foundation, Ole Sio Siomaga Society Incorporated, Samoa, Kaupuni o Hawaii, Keata Tino Toa, Guahan Coalition for Peace and Justice, Guahan Indigenous Collective, Inatan Gef Pago, Famoka Sayan, and the National Association of Social Workers, Guam Chapter 1, Nacion Chamorro. Yes, I made the change this morning, but I understand that it was already printed, so. But you can see Indigenous World Association was originally a part of it, and Kenneth Deere is the speaker on that part, if there's no issue.
Okay, well, apparently we have a little confusion in terms of the procedure with the Secretariat, but we can straighten that out at 1 o'clock.
Okay.
So if Kenneth and the both of you come up to the podium, and we'll clear that up. I'm sure it's just
Thank you very much. A
minor confusion, so sure. I apologize for that.
Thank you.
You very much.
We do, too.
Mm-hmm. In the meantime...
So continuing with the speakers list in terms of Indigenous peoples and corporations, I'd like to call on Dennis Eggington from the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia. Sir, are you in the room?
Yes.
Oh, very good.
It's not Dennis.
Madam? And if you would introduce yourself, please.
Did you hear what she said?
Madam, you have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sandy Miller. I'm speaking instead of Mr. Eglinton. Indigenous communities in Australia are under increasing pressure from states and industry, more so extractive industries, to gain access to traditional lands, particularly in resource-rich regions. With economic development and in particular heavy mining activities comes the need for increased corporate social responsibility protections and initiatives. Some major companies in Australia are setting high standards for maintaining a good corporate citizen reputation. However, many others are not. Indigenous peoples in Australia note the move by the Canadian state to appoint a corporate social responsibility councillor with a specific mandate to review the corporate social responsibility practices of Canadian extractive sector companies operating outside Canada. This is a positive initiative. While some corporations in the extractive industry offer limited benefits to Indigenous communities by way of employment, training and business development, there are a large number that see the native title component of the Australian approvals process as a mere box-ticking exercise. This means that rather than engage fully and effectively with traditional owners about exercise to land, they merely undertake the minimal compliance necessary to satisfy bureaucratic red tape. It is incumbent on the states like Australia to encourage and expect communities to meet high standards of corporate social responsibility. There are many resource projects already underway in Australia which have a downflow effect for other small businesses, and many more are in the planning and construction phases. This will mean increased expectations on more timely and trouble-free access to land, bringing both tribulations as well as potential economic benefits to traditional owners. It is imperative that these industries maintain high standards in dealing with communities. Corporate social responsibility is about mitigating as much as possible the negative impacts of development projects on local communities, and this includes engaging with local communities, particularly traditional owners. Engagement with traditional owners and free, prior and informed consent should form part of the development process. The key to social responsibility is engagement and being inclusive of Indigenous people's needs and aspirations, as well as recognising their own social, economic and cultural responsibilities for community and caring for country. traditional owners in Australia call on the state of Australia to develop accountability systems on industry best practice for the highest standards to ensure maximum corporate social responsibility standards are developed and maintained by not only the extractive industries but also other areas as well. This position should also ensure the same standards are maintained by Australian industry companies, particularly extractive industries operating outside Australia. And our recommendation, Madam Chair, is that the Permanent Forum develop a mechanism on corporate social responsibility within the United Nations framework that meets human rights standards to encourage states to implement and protect the social, economic and cultural rights of Indigenous peoples. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for your presentation and your excellent recommendation. Thank you, Madam. I would like to ask and invite the distinguished representative from the country of Vietnam to speak. Sir, Madam, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson, for giving me the floor. And I'd like to speak in response to the statement made earlier by Youth Caucus. First, I am obliged to express our opposition to what Youth Caucus said at the end of their statement about our government's policy, because we believe that it's based on totally fabricated and groundless information about our government's policy. And second, I'd like to suggest, Madam Chairperson, to remind delegates to focus on the topic we are discussing under this agenda item in the interest of the forum. And we do hope that delegates will not use the floor, to address real issues of Indigenous people and not for their political motivation. I thank you, Madam Chairperson.
I'd like to thank the distinguished representative from the government of Vietnam for her statement and also her reminding us to stay within the agenda item and topic of our agenda. Thank you, Madam, for your intervention. Also, this afternoon, I would like to announce that the Permanent Forum will continue its consideration of Agenda Item 7 in accordance with the program of work as contained in the document and the proposal of work that you have. The meeting of the forum will take place in this conference room 1, and we will be reconvening at 3 o'clock. And the Secretariat has a few announcements, so if you will give her your kind attention, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just one announcement that tomorrow at 8:30 in the morning, there will be a meeting of Global Indigenous Caucus in this very room, NLB1, at 8:30 in the morning. Thank you.
We will be adjourned until 3 o'clock. Everyone, have a good afternoon. Thank you. Great. Thank you. Thank you.